I am speaking as someone who is neither a theologian nor even an academic, but merely a journalist. And so everything that I take, everything that I say will be said with a certain casualness, lack of precision and rigor, and all the other qualities to which readers of newspapers are accustomed to from their columnists. But I'm going to sort of make some generalizations about what I see as sort of the trajectory of the modern university in the West, and particularly the United States over the last 100 to 150 years, and use that to sort of briefly try and illuminate some of the present controversies on campus, most of which seem to have very little to do with Roman Catholicism, but in fact do, I think, have something to do with religion, and that, of course, is not an idea that's at all unique to myself. I'm stealing it from others, but hopefully I'll give you an interesting spin on it. And then I'll conclude by trying to talk about where and how the Catholic University can and should position itself in response to these developments, and also sort of both the promise and the opening, but also the particular challenge facing the Catholic University as it tries to sort of deal with this larger academic reality. So I think it's fair to say that if you look back over sort of the course of the development of the modern university system that has become sort of the engine of meritocracy that we all know and love, what you see is a sort of period of extended secularization proceeding across the second half of the 19th century and continuing, obviously, into the 20th, first affecting Protestant colleges and universities in such a sweeping way, in fact, that most, if not all, of our prominent universities have forgotten that they were once Protestant at all. I went to Harvard, and our official motto is, of course, Veritas. And if you look very carefully at the corners of certain plinths and monuments around Harvard's campus, you can actually find the older motto, which was Veritas Pro Christi et Ecclesia. Nobody on Harvard's campus even really remembers any of that, except in sort of generic and vague references to Puritans, which in fact are in the process of being scrubbed out of our school's fight song at this very moment on the grounds that a reference to Puritan stock is potentially racist. So that's sort of the large big picture story. The interesting question is, well, over this period of secularization, what has replaced Protestant Christianity as the sort of, you know, motivating force, animating ideology, reason for being for the university? And I would argue that, in effect, sort of two forces have laid claim or attempted to lay claim to the role that was once played by confessional churches. And one of those forces is, you could sort of usefully just describe it as technocracy. As a spirit of scientific and technical mastery, whose goal is to essentially turn the university into, it sort of combined in interesting ways with meritocracy, but it's to sort of turn the university into an assembly line for people who participate in a ruling class whose goal is, and I'm sure I'm stealing from last night's speaker, Patrick Deneen, in certain ways here, but the sort of mastery of and manipulation of the material world for the material progress of humanity, and of course the maintenance of the rule of this sort of selected elite along the way. And that mentality has been, I think, by far the most successful would-be inheritor of the older Christian vision, not least because it produces goods in various explicit and obvious ways. The research university does research. It effectively, unlocks secrets of the universe. It, helps produce new technologies, new medical developments, new weapons of war, and so on down the list of sort of technical accomplishments. And then it produces people who are reasonably well suited to be sort of the managerial class of a technocratic world. So that is the spirit that effectively prevails in various ways, with obviously distinctions between different fields and departments and areas of study and so on. But it effectively prevails in the explicitly scientific portion of the modern university, but also in the sort of administrative portion. It's the animating spirit behind the entire sort of fundraising and admissions apparatus that governs the modern university. And it's the animating vision in many ways of the social sciences in different ways, and then the graduate schools that are attached to them, law, business, and so on. So that's part of what took over. The other thing that took over is an attempt at a post-Christian humanism, I think, is the best way to describe it. If the sort of original animating spirit of most Western and American universities aspired to be a Christian humanism, then there has been a sort of conscious or unconscious goal to have a replacement that could sort of maintain the humanism without the dogma and eventually without the religion entirely. And this spirit has not been as effective, I would say, in figuring out what it wants to do, what it wants to be, how it wants to have a role in guiding and governing the university, what kind of students it wants to produce, what kind of human beings it wants to produce, what kind of courses it wants to teach, and so on. And one way to look at it, and as I promised, this would be sort of an egregious generalization, is that the humanistic side of the university in the post-Christian dispensation has tended to sort of swing back and forth between, on the one hand, a kind of desperate envy of science, in which humanistic disciplines seek to constantly justify themselves in the kind of most abstruse, highly technical terms, as sort of guilds that are as difficult to enter and understand as, you know, the most abstract school of physics, the most complicated branch of medicine, and so on. A vision that turns the professor of English into the equivalent of a brain surgeon, constantly doing this incredibly technical and precise work, except on texts rather than human flesh, or on both in some cases. But that tendency is, of course, most advanced, again, in sort of the zone of the humanities that actually has some reasonable claim to actual scientific rigor, to, you know, the sort of zone of economics and other social sciences and so on. And those areas have been more successful at sort of attaching themselves to the kind of scientific technocratic side of the university. The other zone, the zone that can't really, you know, that doesn't have deliverables or doesn't claim to have deliverables the way the economics profession at least claims to have deliverables, the areas that, you know, study philosophy and literature and poetry and all that stuff, they have just sort of suffered insofar as they have taken this approach. They have become, a kind of self-perpetuating guild in many departments, but they struggle to get large numbers of students to be attracted to their programs. They lose students in larger and larger numbers to economics and political science and the other sort of social sciences that seem to have more of a claim to offer practical knowledge. And they've created sort of beyond that this kind of impossible job market for the PhDs that they produce, where you have this tiny guild with this tiny number of jobs that everybody's desperately competing to obtain and pursuing these sort of this arcane mastery that has no obvious use beyond the guild, and then you can't get a job in the guild, and then, you know, you turn on the whole system, understandably. So that's sort of one extreme. But then the other extreme is, in a sense, something that I think you've seen informing basically all of the different periods of protest on campus that we've seen since the dawn of sort of the fully technocratic university, starting the protests of the 60s, the sort of eruption of protests in the 1980s and early 1990s, and now our own wave of campus unrest. And what all of these have in common is a desire to sort of take the humanities and place them in the service of a political utopianism. So they solve the problem of you know, what is this all for? What are the, what's the point of having all of these humanities programs if we don't have some sort of larger metaphysical framework to explain them by saying, well, the point is to, you know, to sort of to use the humanities to affect political change, starting on the university campus and then spreading to the wider world. And this, of course, overlaps with, you know, this sort of highly technical and abstract sort of approach to the study of texts and the intense scrutiny of texts and so on. It's often the same kind of people who are drawn to both, but in effect they are, I think, ultimately very different approaches, and they both sort of reflect, one reflects a kind of science envy, and the other reflects a kind of desire to have the humanities represent a kind of highly politicized alternative to a scientific and economic enterprise that is seen as having lost sight of sort of metaphysical horizons, the thirst for justice, the sort of moral vision generally, and so on. And that I think is sort of essentially a useful way of thinking about where the modern university stands. It's basically run by and for technocrats overall. And then it contains within itself this sort of residual humanism that is uncertain of its place and sort of veers back and forth between esoteric science-envying irrelevancy and a kind of sweeping desire for politicization. But what's interesting is that that desire for politicization is the only, in the modern secularized university, it tends to be the only moral language on offer. And so when the sort of technocratic people running modern campuses, running modern universities, need to speak in a language that isn't just technocratic, they reach, I think, not completely insincerely, but at the very least instrumentally, for that sort of, you know, what ends up being a pretty far left-wing kind of language. And so the dynamic of protest on many university campuses, especially over the last 5 years, but really, I think, going back to previous eras as well, is a dynamic of moralistic students trying to hold the university's technocratic masters to the moral premises that the masters sort of adopted in a kind of instrumental, you know, we need some language to talk about. We can't just say we're producing future investment bankers, so we'll talk about multiculturalism and diversity in these various ways. And then the actual moralists on campus come along and say, well, you talk about it. Let's see how that's working out. You know, let's see how your language of gender equality is working out for female students at the fraternity that, you know, that you have to keep running because you want to attract the kind of guys who join fraternities because they're going to be investment bankers and give money to your university to keep the whole apparatus going. So how is that working out for, you know, for gender equality? And, you know, and similarly with race, ethnicity, sexual orientation, and so forth, and then extending into broader political issues as well. So that's the basic dynamic. And as, you know, someone who is some kind of cultural conservative, it's a little strange to watch from the outside, because in certain ways the natural instinct of the conservative watching these campus controversies play out is to, you know, you want to side with the administrators against the students, you know, because technically the administrators' politics are closer to the center than to the left, and so the center is closer to the right, so it's closer to you, right, and so on. But in fact, and this is, you know, I'm speaking personally here, I mean, I went to college between 1998 and 2002, which was basically the highest high tide of technocracy. It was the period when, you know, the end of history was sort of fully realized, when Alan Greenspan had basically figured out, Robert Rubin too, to be bipartisan, had sort of figured out economic policy. When you showed up on campus and you were assured that, you know, it was fine to major in some sort of humanistic pursuit because consulting firms love to hire people who majored in folklore and mythology when you graduated. You know, this was the full flower. It was pre 9/11, before any financial crises and crashes, although those came along in my senior year and so on. And what that meant for me as one of the few actual conservatives on my own elite campus was that I ended up having a sneaking sympathy for the then rather ragtag and irrelevant left-wing activists on campus. because however much I disagreed with many of their overarching premises and specific causes, they at least thought the university needed a moral vision, needed some kind of moral metaphysical horizons, even if they wouldn't have necessarily put it in sort of metaphysical terms. And that sentiment, which I think is a reasonable one, has stayed with me in certain ways as that ragtag campus left has sort of gained influence and power as the sort of technocratic paradigm has come under stress in a lot of different ways, especially over the last 10 years, which is to say that if you can't understand what's happening on campus from any kind of Christian or Catholic perspective, if you don't see that the people who are closest to yearning for the thing are religion, basically, that was banished gradually and in stages from universities founded by Christians long ago, the people who are closest to yearning for that are, in many cases, the activists, the same activists who would also probably like to see our own religion banned or regulated out of existence in various different ways. So it's a paradoxical situation, but it's one in which I think as an outsider to it, it's important to recognize that in many ways, the Catholic vision is at the very least orthogonal to the kind of debates that are happening on campus, and in certain ways veers a bit closer to the, you know, sort of the impulses, if not the specific goals of campus activists, what we think of as the campus far left. And so in that sense, I think it's a, while it is very important for, you know, conservative Catholics to desire there to be opportunities for other conservative Catholics to give a speech on a secular campus without having protesters show up and so on, that, you know, there is a certain practical and pragmatic value in sort of, you know, allying yourself with the forces in the debate that are saying, well, we need to protect free speech and sort of diversity of thought on campus and so on. As important as that is, it's also important to recognize that the basic status quo on campus is that you have a few moralists at war with a sort of vast, amoral, post-Christian apparatus. And that's not a struggle in which it's clear which side, if any, Catholic Christian should be fully on. So that's an attempted sketch of sort of how to see present campus derangements. And I think, you know, you can push it further by getting into specific cases. You know, if you take, you know, I mentioned sort of the paradigmatic fraternity house and so on. You know, if you look at the debates about rape culture and rape on campus, sexual violence on campus, and so on, they are very clearly a kind of, you know, sort of tacitly, if not explicitly, moralistic and puritanical, even, revolt against a basic campus structure that is set up with students as consumers to whom the college is selling an alcohol-fueled good time. And, you know, in that sense, campus feminists are reacting to a sexual landscape that has been very consciously drained of any moral vision, a campus landscape that is sort of designed, again, to sort of offer a kind of, you know, a kind of rumspringa, to put it in Amish terms, to, you know, upper middle class and wealthy kids for 4 years, without having any kind of overarching moral vision about, you know, male-female relationships, what human sexuality is for, anything like that. And so the campus feminists are, in many cases, the only ones groping towards an actual attempt to create an ethic and around sexuality. And, you know, the ethic that they are trying to create, I think, is not, it's not my ethic. It's not a Catholic or a Christian ethic. And it is one that is, you know, as you've seen in sort of the kind of tribunals that are set up and the way young men on campus are often treated, is an ethic that's prone to various kinds of abuses and deserves critiques on all kinds of grounds. But, you know, say what you will about the tenets of moralistic feminism, as, you know, they say in The Big Lebowski, but at least it's an ethos, right? And that's true. And that's true, I think, again and again in a lot of these in a lot of these campus debates. And so, given that, it's worth thinking about sort of what you know, I it's not at all clear to me what the secular university can do about this problem. I was at the University of Chicago a couple months ago doing a panel sponsored by the Lumen Christi organization on campus, which it was sort of a similar kind of conversation, but I was trying to sort of discuss this in terms that a, you know, the once Baptist, now basically secular, if somewhat more conservative than most universities, University of Chicago could sort of internalize. And I didn't actually know precisely what to say, because you could say, well, you just need to become Baptist again. But I mean, as a Catholic, I don't even think that. And, you know, and it's not a message that I think much of the sort of secular portion of my audience would be receptive to. So you end up saying something mealy-mouthed about, you know, how campuses need to have more respect for religion and religious perspectives. And, you know, if they had more respect for that, a certain amount of this sort of effectively religious energy among students could be channeled in, you know, directions other than just sometimes empty forms of protest and so on. And you could have a more serious conversation than you have sort of in these clashing activist groups. But that is all very sort of, you know, mealy-mouthed, and it's not at all clear how it would be operationalized. Whereas for the Catholic university, it's a little easier to give advice, right? The Catholic university has the opportunity to present itself as a real alternative, as a kind of institution that is capable, and this is always the challenge and the thing that sort of the secular university questions, but as an institution that is capable of pursuing some of the laudable goals of this technocratic / secular humanist university model, that is capable of supporting scientific inquiry, as the Catholic Church has, with a few unfortunate exceptions, generally supported in the past, something that is capable of supporting a community of scholarship that is, you know, is not sort of uniformly Catholic and is capable of having vigorous and interesting and serious debates, but doing all of this under the capacious umbrella of a larger metaphysical commitment that, while it can narrow discussion in certain ways, from a secular perspective at least, also offers the kind of metaphysical and moral horizon for real humanistic endeavor and for the everyday and ordinary lives of students that so many people, and especially I think so many young people, clearly find lacking at, you know, a Harvard, a Yale, and there are many imitators around the country. So that I think, right, NYU. Ivy League snobs are the worst. So I think that's the correct way of looking at the Catholic University's challenge and opportunity at the present moment. But it's not sufficient, I think, to leave it there, because there is, you know, saying it that way, presenting that as the challenge and the opportunity, makes it sound a little bit easier than it really is. It makes it sound like it's just a matter, let's say, of having a kind of, you know, friendly internal debate among, you know, the different parts of the university that enable you to eventually have a more robust Catholic identity, which in turn, you know, sort of, it's basically saying, well, all we need to do is sort of resist the secularization of the Catholic university, resist that secularization, and then the Catholic university can present itself fully as an alternative to the secular model. But the other problem is that, you know, Catholic universities live and operate in the same general social environment, the same social and academic environment as other universities, and they have, you know, budgets and enrollment goals to hit and all of the other things that their more secular alternatives deal with all the time and think about all the time and so on. And they're trying to attract students who, while they may have, you know, technically gone to Catholic school, as we heard from the previous lecture, are not necessarily better formed in the faith than, you know, sort of their more secular counterparts. And all of this means that, you know, that the modern university is designed around a kind of market system, and Catholic universities are players and actors in that market. And it's I think, certainly true that there is a Catholic version of education that offers an alternative that speaks to many of the yearnings and longings of students educated under secularism. But it's also true that the baseline expectation of both students and parents as they approach sort of the, you know, shelling out thousands and thousands of dollars for 4 years of college is the technocratic experience, right? And so this is sort of the, and this is true even on campuses that are sort of seen from the outside are sort of viewed as dominated by radicals right now, right? I mean, if you go to campuses where there's been unrest and you talk to students and you go around and so on, the percentage of students that are sort of driving, are sort of activists who are participating in the unrest, who may, if my theory is right, have this sort of, you know, deep metaphysical yearning that's not being satisfied by their school, that's still like 10 or 15% of the student body, right? And then maybe there's another 2 to 4% that are actually some kind of conservative. And then the rest of the student body is, you know, they may not be fully happy with technocracy. They might have some, you know, some sort of doubts about it that might lead them to wander into a course on the Catholic intellectual tradition or something. But by and large, they're not unhappy enough with it to want some dramatic alternative. And so I'm thinking about this because I just read a really interesting piece that maybe a few of you read in the Chronicle of Higher Education about Catholic U in Washington, D.C., which has spent a certain amount of time under its current president and over the last 5 or 10 years sort of trying, in effect, to sort of regain or rebuild a robust Catholic identity along something vaguely like, I think, the lines that I've just described, to sort of establish and maintain and renew the university as a kind of more fully Catholic alternative to secularizing Catholic schools, perhaps like one that's also located in Washington, D.C., and also explicitly secular universities. And the Chronicle piece, and, you know, this is all, I mean, it's run through the sort of biases of the reporter and the people they talk to and so on, but the thrust of the Chronicle piece was that as Catholic U has done this, they've had a certain amount of confusion from prospective students and from parents and applicants and so on, who are like, well, you know, people who would sort of naturally apply to Catholic U because it's a good school and it's sort of technically Catholic and it's in the right range in the U.S. news rankings, but then they go in and they say, well, this seems a little more religious than I was bargaining for, right? And this is, you know, and as a result, there have been enrollment shortfalls and sort of various issues. And again, I don't know if the details of all of this are correct, but as an observer of the American landscape, it rings very true, I think, that if you suddenly took, let's say, every university in the Jesuit tradition, so to speak, around the U.S. and said, over the next 5 years, we're going to make them more robustly Catholic, more fully Catholic, that would clearly present, over the long term, I think, a plausible alternative to the university system as it currently exists. It would clearly be satisfying, very satisfying, to that 10 or 15% who are sort of deeply dissatisfied with the current system's limited metaphysical horizons. But it would also just confuse the heck out of the kind of people who send their kids and who go to those schools right now, for whom the university is supposed to be a place where you do what you want for 4 years. You go to a lot of parties. Theoretically, you have sex. You know, there's less sex than there used to be, and there wasn't ever that much sex. But theoretically, you have a lot of sex. You get drunk, and you get educated in a way that makes you capable of earning $200,000 a year X years down the line. That's what the university's for. It's nice if it has a Catholic patina, and maybe you go to Mass occasionally. But anything beyond that, it's just weird. And so I think that's the opportunity for the Catholic university then coexists with a dilemma, which is to say, drawn up on paper, the Catholic intellectual tradition offers a really plausible and interesting alternative to this messed up place where the modern university has ended up. But it's one thing to draw it up on paper. It's another thing to move these huge sort of, you know, these huge institutions that Catholic universities as well as secular universities have become in this direction, while also attracting the number of students that you need to run the university when the bulk of those students have just, they just expect the technocratic from the university. They don't expect what the church in its fullness potentially has to offer. So on that sort of pessimistic and uncertain note, I think I'm going to turn things over to a panel who will pick apart what I've said and say much more interesting things in their turn. So thank you all very much.